Friends with Brews.
Bart Bouchotz, you are... I wish you were the first guest on Friends with Brews without Peter here, but you're not. But you're still a very rare guest on Friends with Brews without Peter here, so welcome.
I feel honored. Well, that is so cool.
I don't know if you should feel honored or not. That's something... You may have to change your mind about that later, but we'll see. So the premise of the podcast is... we like brewed things, whether they be beer, coffee, or tea. And because it's 10:30 a.m. my time, I've gone the tea route. And You look like you have a warm beverage as well. What do you have?
I have a warm beverage. I have an ironic warm beverage. I have a warm cold brew coffee.
So it was warm, you made it cold, and then it warmed up again.
No, the other way around. It was cold and I made it warm. So cold brew coffee is basically, it takes about 24 hours, but you basically make the coffee without applying heat. And then you end up with very concentrated coffee that keeps for days.
Okay.
And then when you want a cup, you basically, like it was a cordial drink, you just basically put a bit in the bottom of your cup and then top it up with boiling water. And you have... Well, it's not just that it's convenient. It's also very different in taste because none of the bitter notes come through with the cold brew.
Yeah.
So the same bean is way sweeter when you cold brew it than when you regular brew it. So my better half has gone completely nuts on cold brew. I went nuts on every other kind of coffee. But my darling beloved went nuts on cold brew, and I let him at it, and he was kind enough to have a batch ready for today, and I thought, well, that's perfect.
Yeah, that is perfect. That's pretty awesome. I have to admit, I have had a lot of cold brew, but I've never warmed it back up again, so that's an interesting tip.
Yeah, I use it as if it was a shot of espresso.
Interesting. I like that. I'll have to give that a try. My wife's got some kind of creamer that she puts in, and normally I just drink my coffee black. I don't put anything in coffee.
Me too.
But she's got some creamer that when she mixes it in just the right quantity of cold brew, oh, it's amazing. My problem is I would go through gallons of it if I drank that. So I have to refrain. Okay, interesting. All right, well, we learned something here today, which is more than we can usually say.
Well, the only thing I ever put in coffee is a little bit of syrup sometimes. So I at the moment, I have a bottle of, it's one called Skinny Something. And it's 11 calories for a tablespoon, and it's this delicious, rich toffee flavor. Now, I don't have it in the cold brew because that'd be a waste of... But on a weekend, I like to give myself something a little bit special in my coffee.
Boy, you're just full of good ideas today of things I'm going to have to try.
There you go.
When I do, I'll label them the Bart Special. Okay, so here's what I have. I have got myself a green tea. This is not a very fancy green tea, Bart. What I'm saying is this is not loose leaf tea. This is...
No.
Is my picture backwards to you or forward?
No, it's for... I'm intrigued by the word rice on the front of it.
Yeah, they like to put rice... They put toasted rice in with the green tea, and usually they call it genmaicha when they do that, but I don't... This just says matcha toasted rice, because they also threw some matcha in, which is the powdered green tea, and...
Huh. Wait, hang on. So it has leaf as well as powdered, as well as rice?
Correct.
So how do you make that?
So that's the interesting part of it. This is just in tea bags, which is not how I normally have my tea. I normally have little leaves that are crushed up. But yeah, it just comes in little bags.
Ha! Huh. That is a very unusual cup.
Yeah, it is very unusual. It's not bad. I kind of like it. Is it the world's most exquisite green tea? No. Could you get better green tea? Yes. Do I like this? Yes, I do. And it's so easy to make. So I'm good with this tea for today.
So the powdered green tea, does that make it the tea a more... What does that do to the flavor to have some powdered mixed in with the leaf?
It's usually a better quality of tea. I don't know if they used it here, but it's usually a better quality of tea. And my guess is it also dissolves into the water a little bit differently too. But yeah, if you've ever had matcha powder...
Well, I've never had powdered tea, so that's what I'm intrigued by.
Yeah, matcha powder tea can be very strong. And if you're drinking it as tea, it needs to be prepared pretty carefully. I've made straight matcha tea, and my results were not good. I haven't practiced enough. But matcha powder is great for things like dumping on vanilla ice cream. Who knew? It's pretty amazing. Yeah. That's something that I discovered in a local ice cream shop. I walked in there and there was a matcha soft serve. So I I ordered that, and it was matcha powder dumped on vanilla ice cream, and it was really good.
So like you do with powdered sugar, just a little sieve and just tip, 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 and just sprinkle it over the top?
Yeah.
Ha! Huh. And it'd be green.
And it was green, yeah, green and white, and it was great.
I need to find something orange to go with it and then call it a St. Patrick's Day special or something.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, a very humble tea here, but good. I like it. I'll definitely buy more of this stuff because it's so easy to prepare. It's a nice, you know, be warm in the evening, but not necessarily drink coffee type of brew.
And because it's green tea, I'm guessing it's not going to keep you awake.
Yeah, this says medium caffeine, which is interesting. Normally I would think that green tea would be low to medium. But yeah, you're right. It's definitely lower caffeine than coffee for sure. For sure.
That's a pretty low bar.
It is a low bar, yeah. But yeah, that's me today.
Excellent. Cool.
So I have some questions for you, Bart.
Okay.
I don't remember if we've talked about your Mac setup before. What are you currently using?
Right now, this second, I am on my home podcasting rig, which I recently refreshed. So this is all extremely shiny at the moment. So it is a Mac Studio with a studio display on a boom arm with a... I don't have a new mic because I really love my mic, but I got a new boom arm that fits perfectly. I have a Wave XLR audio unit, which is exactly the same size as a Stream Deck and by the same company. And they're designed to just pair next to each other. So it's like this little perfect panel of goodness.
Oh.
And then the big, because I believe in number pads, the big wireless Apple keyboard in black with the Magic Trackpad.
Interesting. Oh my God, what a nice computer. I'm using an Ergo arm or a boom arm for my monitor as well. I have an Apple Studio display. And then I have a 2021 M1 Pro MacBook Pro right now. Boy, do I love that computer. Before that, I had a 2015 iMac 5K. The thing that I love about this, besides the obvious performance enhancement, is the M series chips just revolutionized laptops for me.
Oh,
because I used to hate laptops. Noisy, compromised.
Yeah, and they're not warm.
Right.
They last like an iPad in terms of battery. It is kind of magical.
It is, very much.
We've come so far from the days of the Intel transition. I presume any Intel apps I'm running are being in the wild translated on the go.
Yeah.
I don't notice.
You can't tell. Yeah, I was playing some 3D game that does not run native. It's being translated, and I'm getting 60 frames per second. It's like crazy.
That's all you want, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it does an amazing job, yeah. And by the way, speaking of Wave XLR, I'd heard of Wave XLR before, but you are the person that actually inspired me to run out and purchase one, because I heard you talking about it with Allison, I think.
Well, Allison got me onto it.
Okay.
And Allison, yeah. So I think there's a couple of things I love about it. It's super. Supremely simple, right? Because I don't want big knobs and things. So it has one giant big knob in the middle. That's the volume knob.
Yep.
And it has just one input at the back. And I think the best thing is, you know, like an old-fashioned alarm clock where you have the capacitive snooze?
Mm-hmm.
That is your software mute. And because it's a software mute, it doesn't give a click. It's a perfectly silent mute. And it's just you tap it in software and then all the lights on the front of the device go red. So it's like, auga, auga, you're on mute, which is what I want.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love it so much compared to what I was using. I don't remember off the top of my head. I'd have to look it up what I was using. But it was a standard little USB interface with two XLR inputs and all the normal knobs that you would expect. And it was okay. And it could certainly, like, for example, if I ever had multiple people recording locally, which I never do, that would be a better solution. But I don't have that need. And this is so much better for podcasting for one person for all the reasons that you just stated. It's so nice. Yeah, I'll never go back.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad Allison put me onto it, because for years I was still using USB interfaces, but this, just nicer to have. Actually, I have one of the few mics that has two holes in the bottom, a USB hole and an XLR hole. So I've actually been able to upgrade without changing my mic. What are you?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, it's an ATR or something or other. Oh, I do a Technica ATR. I think it's a 221. I think that's the difference in the 20 and the 21, is that it does the USB and the XLR.
What do I have? I have a. Oh, mine's a Shure Beta 87A. I've had an ATR in the past, and I don't know why I don't have it now. But I noticed that your mic is pretty good at capturing your voice in all its rich entirety, even though you don't have your mic close. I tend to have a volume problem anyway, and with this mic, it's got severe drop-off, so I've got to get my face right up on it.
Yeah, I find I pop my peas too much if I'm in too close. So.
Yeah.
Now, I do also have it going through. So I use Audio Hijack. And so the raw mic goes into Audio Hijack, and then it goes through an AU Dynamics block where I actually have a bunch of tweaking done to it.
Oh, okay.
And then it goes from there out to loopback to become a pretend audio device, which Skype thinks is a real mic.
Right. Same here. Yeah. That's how I mix the Farrago soundboard with my mic using loopback.
Nice. Great app.
It is a great app. And by the way, one of the other features of the Wave XLR that we should talk about, speaking of software adjustments, is that you can have I don't remember what it's called, if it's called peak limiter or what. But anyway, there's a software peak limiter in there. And it works pretty well. I tested it, and you can do some pretty good yelling, and it'll keep you from clipping. So just having that built into your mic interface, super nice.
And it's kind of where it belongs, right? If you think about it logically, surely to goodness, that is what audio processing units should be doing.
Absolutely, yeah. You shouldn't plug in a mic, hook it up, and then have to run around adjusting a bunch of different software in order to not ruin the sound of your audio.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, make the computer do the donkey work. That's my motto in life. Just for all sorts of things, make the computer do the work.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I've said that to other people. Make the computer work for you instead of the other way around. Now, sometimes I do work for my computer, but hopefully it's usually by choice, and it's because I'm just doing something fun and dumb, and I know I'm being fun and dumb, and that's that. So
I sometimes get a wee bee in my bonnet. It's like, well, I am determined to have it go like this. I don't care if this is not the path of least resistance. I am going to win this battle, and I will right. do that. But that's a choice. That's, yep. Pigheadedness. It could be fun.
So you have a job that is either or at least involves system administration. Is that correct?
That was correct until a few months ago. So most of my professional career, I've been a dog's body sysadmin, I call it. So mm-hmm. We are a small IT department in an Irish university. So I was one of only four sysadmins, which means you have to do everything, mm-hmm. right? If you're one of four, and we were a pretty heterogeneous sort of a place. So yeah, we had more Linux servers than anything else, but we also had Windows servers. We had stuff in the cloud. We had a lot of stuff going on. And so that actually was really nice to be very broad. But for the last quite a few years, I've been focusing in on sort of volunteering. Every time there was something to do with security, I would volunteer to take that on, and I would be proactively looking for security related stuff I could bring to the team. And so I was kind of trying to live the job I wanted. And then finally they advertised the job I wanted, which was cybersecurity specialist. And so I applied for the job I wanted, and I did get it, thankfully.
That's awesome. I am a firm believer in the try to live the job you want. And obviously that doesn't work for everyone, but when you can make it work, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it took me two goes to get the job. So the first time they hired no one, which was a bit weird to interview for a job in your own building and not get it because no one got it. But they tweaked the job spec. I went off and did a whole bunch of training. Mm-hmm. And I don't generally believe in getting the paper just to have the paper. But if you're applying for a job, maybe
yeah,
I do.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, like, I know Peter's a consultant. He also works for a hospital in Boston as one of their security guys. And he did go and get some of those security certificates for exactly the same reason. And it does help in certain jobs. There's just no way around it.
Yeah. And in this case, one of the things so when they redid the spec for Take Two, one of the things they really focused on was self-learning. And I was like, okay, so don't tell them you would be great at learning stuff. Show it.
Yeah.
So I basically went and got myself a bunch of the Microsoft certifications because, you know, at that time, we were Sentinel was our main security platform. So we were all big in the Microsoft space.
Yeah.
And so I'm a Microsoft certified cybersecurity, whatever it is. I got two Microsoft certifications within the space of 2 months, actually, which is pretty tough going. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that way I was able to go into the second interview and say, you put a real focus on self-learning. Well, I've taught myself this. I recently did these two certificates. And that, I think that helped me a lot,
yeah,
to be able to really show it.
I'm absolutely sure it did, yeah. First of all, it shows that you were capable of earning those certificates, but it also shows that you said, I'm going to go do it, and you did it. So I don't see a downside to that. I'm sure, well, I haven't been certified for anything Microsoft related, but I'm sure it's not cheap to do, though.
Ah, you see, there are advantages. So one of the, when you're working in the education sector, Microsoft love you. Because what they really want is for the entire education sector to run on Microsoft products so that when people leave, they just unthinkingly keep doing what they're used to doing.
Sure.
So that means you need to keep the university sysadmins really happy so that they keep rolling out Microsoft services. So we get offered, I think it's up to 12 a year, where we can do a one-day training course spread over 2 days and the free matching Microsoft exam.
Oh, wow.
Or rather, the matching Microsoft exam for free.
That's good. Wow.
That's amazingly good. Yeah. Now, they only let you do it once, right? So you get one shot at every exam, which is reasonable, right? Don't waste your time.
Right, right.
But so I basically made use of it twice in a row. So they offered, there was training going for, they were security related certifications from Microsoft. And they just fit perfectly with what we were doing in work and our setup. And I just went for them and took the exam and got the exam. I stressed about it a lot. And then I got, I think it was 70% was the passing grade. And I stressed and I stressed and I got 98. So,
yeah. You're their star student. Well, you probably wouldn't have done so well if you hadn't been stressed a little bit, at least. If you hadn't cared,
absolutely.
At least a tiny.
Yes. Yeah, no, that, I mean, you're dead right. That's sort of the way it goes. I think it goes with every test. The ones you're not planning, the ones you think are going to be easy are the ones you mess up.
Oh, yeah.
And the ones you stress about, you do great at. Not because you shouldn't have stressed, but because you actually put, because you're appropriately concerned.
Yep. Yeah. Which is the chicken and the egg? You're a very techie person. Did you go to the job already with some of those administration skills intact? Or did you kind of go sideways into that job and then really start learning from there?
That's an interesting question. Sideways is certainly probably the closest description. So I did a degree in computer science, which I also slipped into sideways because I thought I was going to be a physicist. I was convinced I was going to be a physicist. So I went to Maynooth University because they had a really good physics department. And in particular, I wanted to be an astronomer. And there's only one famous Irish astronomer and she was at Maynooth. And so I went to Maynooth because that's where she was. And I realized quite quickly that I hate mathematics. Like, I really hate mathematics. I didn't know I did, but I do. I'm great at arithmetic and I'm great at all the stuff you do before you go to university. But at the university level with the Simpson's theorem on the plane, I was like, no. So I ended up, I had to choose. I did probably the best thing I ever did was to do an omnibus science degree, is what we called it. So you didn't have to pick your specialty up front. You basically came in as a first year and you had to pick four subjects. And then you only after the first year did you start to narrow it down to three, then two, and then either one or two for your final year. And so I knew I wanted physics. So they had experimental physics and mathematical physics, and mathematics was compulsory. So they were my three I just knew I wanted. And then I had this fourth subject. And I was like, well, I really don't like chemistry and I'm really not good at learning, you know, names and things. So biology is probably not my thing. What else have they got here? Oh, computer science. I like games. I'll do that. And I ended up, the mathematical physics got dropped first. The mathematics got dropped second. And I ended up doing a double major in experimental physics and computer science. And to be honest, the experimental physics didn't really get used afterwards. I ended up as a computer scientist. And then I went to be a grad student and then funding got cut off. And I also realized I hate academia. I actually hate writing journal papers.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it turns out that's not my cup of tea at all. But I was working on a really fun research project and I was doing a lot of coding, but the code had to run somewhere. So I was also doing a lot of sysadmining. And then in my spare time, I was in the IT society and they were running really cool servers and things. And so I ended up becoming a sysadmin by accident.
Yeah.
And then a job came up in the university's IT department for a sysadmin. And I didn't really want to leave Maynooth because it's a cool place. And I just ran out of money for the, you know, PhD I didn't really want. And so I took the job in IT services. And that's sort of where I've been since.
Well, explain to me how that works. Because here in the United States of America, when we think of education in other countries like yours, we think, oh, my God, they're doing it right. They want their people to be educated and they don't have to go, you know, deeply into debt to do education. But you said you ran out of money for your PhD. So how does that work?
Well, okay. So Okay, so while I was doing the PhD, there was funding for the project for 3 years.
Okay.
Which meant that that would pay me a stipend and pay for all of the equipment and stuff. And the funding for the project fell apart, which then left me sitting there going, well, either I can start to go into debt and go from being paid a stipend of, it was $1,200 a month back in the in the early 2000s.
Ooh.
Which is, you know, I mean, rent and stuff. Yeah, it was basically rent. It was half of it was rent and half of it was living. But that was fine, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely, it was fine. And while that was funding was going, I was quite happy. But then when the money ran out, I was like, yeah, do I actually want to go into debt here to do this PhD? I'm not entirely sure I want. Or do I want to go get a job? And so I went and got a job.
I love the description of the system there where you can kind of take your time choosing. And that's one thing that we've definitely lost over here, just for the simple economic reason that you can't afford to experiment anymore. You're lucky if you can afford to go to university to begin with. And then you have to know what you want to do and get it done and don't screw up, because it just is too bloody expensive to experiment now, which I think is incredibly insane, because how many people know what they want to do when they go to university?
Well, the thing is, so I didn't change program. So what I did was what we call the omnibus science. Which basically means you know you're doing science and you're on a railroad, but it's a pretty broad railroad and you get to pick and choose on that railroad. And that was the fashion back in my day. And then it went out of fashion for a while and they started having these really specialized degrees. Like my brother went off to become bioinformatics, which is like a very small subset of biology and computer science all mushed together. And he ended up transferring out of that into an omnibus science degree. Because he was over-specialized. And since then, the trend has completely reversed and we're back to omnibus, but not just omnibus. So our university has taken the lead in taking down the barriers between the faculties. So you can actually go to Maynooth and do experimental physics and French.
Oh, wow.
You can, so we have just removed so many of the barriers so that the amount of permutations, I think someone worked it out that there's like 4 million different degrees possible if you take all the different permutations. Not that anyone does it quite that nuts, but basically you can, as long as you end up with the appropriate number of credits at the end of every semester, you can proceed and there's almost no barriers.
Well, at least if you want to be a professional student, there's plenty of options for you to experiment with.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And if you can find yourself a research area you're interested in that's funded, then you can continue to do, master's, PhD or whatever afterwards too in a very broad range of topics. That's the other thing actually the university has done is it used to have lots of separate research institutes, which would be named after famous people. And they've ended up sort of pulling those back and basically gone, we now have one research institute for the whole of social sciences and one research institute for the whole of the sciences. Which means that it's interdisciplinary by the fact that it's so broad. And so that actually results in way cooler research when you don't force people into these narrow little bits.
For sure. Yeah, you can come across stuff more naturally, probably.
And a lot more, I hate this word, but it's an appropriate word, a lot more synergy. You end up, because you're in the same institute, you end up having coffee with people who do very different things to you and ideas spark. So probably the other very clever thing they did was that they put the IT services department on the same floor of the same building as the computer science department. And it's very, very rare for admin departments and academic departments to cohabit a space like that. But it has actually sparked a lot of really useful things in both directions.
Interesting.
So it's kind of been fun that they thought so broadly to put the IT people together so they could cross-pollinate, whether they were admin or whether they were academic.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talk a lot about Apple wanting people to go back to campus, and there's views on both sides where you don't hear the more tempered views on it, but you hear the people that are completely furious that Apple would do such thing, and then you hear the people that think that going back to work is the only way to do things. First of all, I work in semiconductor test in a group that tests and develops roadmap for the software that runs on the equipment. So I do a lot of hands-on stuff. I have to be at the tool a lot of times. Sometimes I don't. I can do a lot of my testing remotely. And so I do work from home sometimes. But even without that, I am very much a person that gains more from being able to stand there at the tool with somebody, looking them in the eyes. There's just some better learning that takes place for me. It's so much better. And so I think that companies should be flexible when they can, but I also totally love the in-person thing as well.
I discovered, thanks to the pandemic, that for me it's a yes and. Mm-hmm. So during the pandemic, initially I really liked it because I was so much more productive. I was getting a lot more done because I'm an introvert, and just being able to be in the zone and stay in the zone and not be pulled out of the zone by all the stuff that happens in an open plan office really worked for me. Mm-hmm. And so for the first few months, I was actually really quite happy at home. And it was also, I have a respiratory condition. My hubby has a really serious respiratory condition. So we were kind of in hermit mode pretty strongly. And so, well, I was quite happy. Well, on the scale of how one was during the pandemic, I was quite happy. But after a year, because we worked from home for a year and a half, full time. So after the first year, I began to feel isolated. Mm-hmm. I began to feel disconnected from the team. We were fraying at every edge you could imagine. Mm. We'd forgotten that we're all human and we all have our own, you know, we don't mean, we ended up taking the wrong tone from text conversations. And it's,
yeah.
We just began to fray, is the best way to describe it. We just began to fray. And so we've now switched to a hybrid model where it's three in, two out. And I think the ideal for me would be three out, two in, because I am the introvert.
Yeah.
But no time in the office is terrible. It was bad for the team. And it was even bad for me. Even though I am an introvert, and even though I do a lot better with focus time, you do actually need to bounce ideas off people. You actually need to have a certain amount of time where you can just... I call it prairie dogging. We just stand up in the cubicle farm and go, oi, anyone?
Yeah.
Anyone know what the heck, you know, is going on with this minus whatever flag to whatever? You know, and usually you get some sort of a sensible answer in our place. And so I need a bit of that.
I agree. And I think I'm introverted in some ways too, although probably some of my coworkers would disagree because I can never shut up. But I also think that having that in-person connection, like people are so different in text, and even sometimes they come across so different on calls. And most of our calls we do on Teams, we're not doing video calls. Most of our calls are just voice calls, which is better than just text.
We have a video pod. We turn on our video, and I really, really think that helps. I think that helps so much to not dehumanize the calls, is to have, and we don't necessarily leave it on, but we will start a call with video and a couple of minutes of chit-chat, always. Okay. And the video is really important. And then usually once we get, you know, okay, right, what's our agenda today? You'll see all the videos go off. Just, you know.
That's a good approach.
But that's fine.
I like that. You know, yeah, seeing people's faces, it just serves as a, why we function this way, I don't know. Why we can't adapt better, I don't know. But it serves as a reminder that, hey, I like and trust these people. These are my people. It just gives you that feeling that you cannot get any other way.
I think we humans, I think it's utterly subconscious, but we read faces, we read signals, we read body language.
Yeah.
And we can hear it a bit in the voice and we can see it relatively well in video, but there's nothing that beats the in-person. So I think it is actually a spectrum between in-person, video, voice, and text is just, text is off the list. Text is terrible.
Text is terrible. And I'm bad at text, and I'm really bad at taking the wrong tone from text. And I've had a number of online communications that have gone awry 100% because of me, but it's just how it works for me. And then when I talk to the person in voice or whatever, I realize, oh, it's completely different. I was totally off base there. You know, it just...
I know exactly what you mean.
Why I have that problem, I don't know.
I actually got some... I learned it on a podcast. I don't remember which one, but I learned it on a podcast. I'm not going to take credit for this advice, but I found it really helped me during the pandemic. It's called steel manning. So you know the way a straw man is, where you take the weakest possible argument from your opponent and then knock it down like a blade of, you know, straw, because it's easy. Steel manning is where you proactively do the opposite. You find the most benign possible tone in your head for the piece of text, because all the text is fluffy, right? There's a spectrum of choice. And so always take the most benign possible interpretation and reply in that tone.
Mm.
80% of... No, I don't know what percentage. Some percentage of the time, you are replying with a really nice way to a really snotty email. But the thing is, when you do that, you knock the other person out of it. You snap them out of the snottiness. And so even when you were right, you've saved yourself escalating. And when you were wrong, and that they actually were being snotty, you still usually break the cycle. You still usually end up bringing the whole project, the whole conversation back on a firm footing, because you've now taken the moral high ground, and it's really hard for someone else to keep being snotty when someone is just not taking the bait.
For sure. For sure.
It'll always work, but you know, it has helped me a lot.
No, that is really good. Yeah, it's something that I've been working on, and for how old I am, the fact that it's taken me this long to even become a tiny bit better at it is pretty wrong. You know, it's a failure of mine, I see it as, but at least...
I wouldn't go that far.
It would have been optimal to be better early on.
We're not... Like, who teaches these things? Right? It's not part of our education, so I think becoming self-aware is really bloody difficult, and we're not helped, and there's not enough mentors left in the world these days. Everyone seems to be just sort of in a race to the top, and no one's mentoring anyone else. So I think it's a side effect of where we are in our society that it takes a bit of work to become self-aware.
Yeah, that could be.
And I'll be honest, I think my marriage is the reason I've become self-aware, because myself and the better half, we had to work really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And this might sound strange, but it should be obvious that that is the relationship where you should give the most leeway, assume the best intent, always come up with the most charitable explanation, and even if something is annoying, be the most relaxed and forgiving about it. And yet, I've talked to people who, when I presented that idea to them, they go, huh, I never thought of it that way. And I'm like, but you... What, you're married to this? What? Ah, it just doesn't make sense.
the other thing I found is always apologize when you realize you were in the wrong, even if it's not expected of you.
Yeah.
And it isn't expected in a relationship, but just do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. Because we all do it. Like, I snap. I do something that I've had a day. I come home. I'm cranky, right? Innocent question. What are we having for dinner? Oh, for God's sake, I'm only just in the door. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, that was out of proportion. That was related to something that guy in the office said that had nothing to do. And I will always make a point of going up and saying, sorry about that. And it's like, you know, you don't have to apologize. It's like, yes, but I do. And when that then mirrors back to you, it is amazing what it smooths over. And the other one is, I'm sorry, you were right. Not I was wrong. You were right.
Yeah, and that's something that I don't know why, but for some reason, when I was younger, for some reason, it hurt me to have to say that.
Oh, big problem for me. Huge problem for me. And I'll tell you what it was. It was insecurity. When you're not sure of your own opinions, it's really hard to say I was wrong.
Sure.
But when you've done the work to get to know things, it's actually quite easy to say, actually, no, I was wrong, and now I've learned something new. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, and... even though it's a different type of relationship, working with the people that I work with in a few different groups and certainly the group that I'm in now, working with the people that I work with has been a huge education in that way, because they're so, trust me, I am the dumbest guy in this group. These people are smart, but I'm in a good group where nobody cares. It's not about being right or proving that you're smart. It's about finding the answer. And they're more than happy to say, oh, okay, that was wrong. I'm wrong. I didn't know that. Or even ask a question. How does this work? Which might seem basic, but nobody's afraid to ask questions. Nobody's afraid to say they were wrong. Nobody's afraid. And you learn that people that are way smarter than you have the ability to say I was wrong or ask a question that might seem stupid. And it's a great example.
There's a causal link between those two things. Because if you go around the place with your shields up and trying to convince yourself at all times that, no, by this technicality, I was right. Mm-hmm. What are you not doing? You're not absorbing anything new. There is nothing coming in, right? You are getting no smarter. You're getting no more nuance in your understanding. You're getting no wiser. You're just going around feeling smug and having every good idea bounce off you.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
No. I remember when I started working at this company, there was a particularly old piece of semiconductor test equipment that we used. And there was one mode of testing. When you were running diagnostics on it, you would go find this cable way underneath the piece of equipment, and you would stick a loopback wire in two of the connectors. And then you could run diagnostics on it. And people would forget and leave it there. And then when they went to do the testing, yeah, this is antique equipment. So when you would do the testing, the actual testing, running production, you would have to take that loopback wire out and reconnect it in the normal way. And people would forget to do that. Well, this one guy knew the symptoms right off the top of his head of what would happen when you left the loopback connector in.
Right.
But he would come in and we'd be like, yeah, I don't know why this thing is doing this because we're brand new. This thing is already antique even when you know, decades ago when I got there. And then he, instead of saying, oh, here's how it works, he goes, oh, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And he waits for a shift pass down to end and for us to leave before he takes care of it. And I always remembered that, because you can serve as an example positively and you can serve as a lesson and an example negatively. And that guy definitely taught me something right there.
Right. And that's the old protectionist attitude of, if I'm the only one who knows this, my job is safe. And that's not how it works.
Right. That is not.
Because that is how you become, oh, that guy. And that's how your job is the opposite of safe. And that's how people try to make sure that you don't get brought into the loop, because if you're in the loop, you'll steal the loop.
Yeah. Which I've never seen it happen. I've never seen somebody give away knowledge and then suddenly be asked to leave.
Yeah, quite the opposite. It's like, oh my God, you're one of those people who I can ask questions of and they share. That's how you build a team. That's how you build it, you know.
That's why you're good. When you were talking about being a physicist, I thought, you know, Bart would have made a great physicist too, because you are very good at breaking down complex topics and phrasing them in ways that, interesting ways of explaining things that make sense, but they're also enjoyable. Like, that's a pretty neat skill that, if you would have been a physicist, I don't know about the math part of it, but you would have done great with communicating ideas to people.
Well, I think I could have been a good physics teacher. I don't think I necessarily would have been a good physicist.
Yeah, okay.
Which is a subtle difference. But no, there is an alternative universe that's not a million miles away where I would have been an educator, because the reason I do so much podcasting and stuff is because I feel the path not taken appeals to me.
Yeah, there's a part of you that is fulfilled by getting to explain stuff, getting to work on stuff to people,
Yeah. And I have a colleague who feels very similar to me, and he does the same thing by doing part-time teaching. He teaches two courses a year.
Oh, interesting.
Whereas I choose to do it as the podcasting. But either way, both of us are scratching that itch of, I really enjoy teaching. There is something wonderful about seeing the penny drop. There is nothing more rewarding in life than seeing the penny drop. You know, we as a universe have gotten a little bit smarter, and that's brilliant.
Yeah. And it also requires, and I'm sure helps develop, the attitude of, oh, these people don't know this thing.
Yet.
Being completely non-judgmental about, exactly that. Not, oh, they're a dummy, why don't they know this thing?
Yeah, what drives me nuts, the thing I can't stand, is willful ignorance.
Right.
I know I don't know this, and I don't want to know.
So I should probably let you go pretty soon here, Bart. But one thing that I'm kind of curious about is, so you've got a lot of hobbies already. You've got podcasting, you've got photography, you've got probably other computer things you do at home. Certainly a lot of work that you do to get ready for the podcast. And then you've got your work-related stuff, which I'm sure that you spend a lot of time thinking about as well. But is there anything recently that has started fascinating you that your mind is working on? It could be anything. It could be societal. It could be scientific. It could be computer related.
At the moment, a lot of my focus is centered on work stuff, which is a bit boring. But one of the things I've been getting into, that's what I've been thinking about a lot, is there's a thing called Ansible. That's a tool for automating sysadmin-y stuff. But it does things in a way that's different to everything else I've learned. So I learned lots of programming languages by now. But Ansible is different, because you don't tell Ansible how. You tell Ansible what.
Interesting.
And its magic is it figures it out. It's a really different way of programming when you're not trying to say step one is do this and step two is do that. You just basically say, I need all of these servers to have this config file with this line. I need this folder to exist with these permissions. I need this package to be installed. And you literally declare, it's like you're God, and you say, universe, there must be so. And you hand it to Ansible, and you give Ansible 100 servers, all in a different state. And Ansible goes to each one, one by one, and figures out the delta between the universe you have requested and reality. And by God, it makes the two line up.
That is interesting.
That's bloody magic.
It's like you're a manager of people that you trust, and you can just set it and forget it type of people where you go, hey, I need this to happen, make it so.
Yeah. And so when you have an estate...
How does it work?
Well, the golden rule to make Ansible work is that at every level, it's what they call idempotent, which means if something is already the way you want it, nothing changes. So it's always safe to run an Ansible rule again. And that is applied down to the smallest level, and then you build up your playbooks by ever bigger levels. But because they're all idempotent down to the little atom, it actually does work that way. But when you have years of technical debt built up, which is certainly what we do. And I think everyone does.
Yeah.
What you have is this sea of different servers that were all hand-built, and everyone had the same destination in mind, approximately, but we all hand-built them, we all did it our own way, and now an auditor comes in and says, well, actually, guys, we really need you all to have a consistent firewall across all of these. Well, to manually do that is such a pain. But when you can rely on plugins that other people have written for Ansible, so you basically, there's an Ansible plugin for Firewall D, when you just basically specify, this is what I need, and then the plugin does all of the donkey work. It's loads of if-else statements, right? Okay, so I need the public view to have these rules. What does it have now? Ah, remove, 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 add, add, add. But at the end of the day, that's all it is. A bunch of comparisons and a bunch of, you know, if should it be here? No. Take it away. Is it not here, but it should be? Yes. Add it in. And that's literally, you know, you do the same thing enough times. But what you're left with is, and it's also in YAML, which is a very, very human-friendly language. It almost looks like Markdown. Like mm-hmm. it makes JSON look complicated, YAML, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're just writing YAML to describe the universe you want, and then you point it at your servers, and you just see all of these beautiful, and it's all color-coded on the terminal. It just comes back, and it gives you a little table at the end of it, and goes, yeah, you sent me 100 servers here to turn on automatic updates with live kernel patching. Okay, 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 okay. And it's like, done. And it's just, makes me very happy.
That is fascinating because we do, one of the things that I do help with at work is I help the guys who install the servers into these semiconductor test equipment, and each one of them has anywhere from 5 to 7 servers, where currently it's like 5. But and then we image them and we set them up, and we use Semantic Ghost. We have USB drives if for some reason we can't use our Semantic jobs, but we have Semantic Ghost and we just run all these jobs against the server, and then in theory they're all the same for each given type of server. Right. But it doesn't always work that way because there's still a tiny bit of human glue that has to happen. There's still a little bit of this, still a little bit of that, and those things get missed.
And over time, they drift, right? If you start off with 5 identical servers, they won't stay identical. But when you manage your 5 identical servers with something like Ansible, if you then need to go make a change, you make the change once in the Ansible playbook and you apply it to the 5 servers so they stay in sync with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, so I've now been playing with Ansible for about 6 months. So initially it was retrofitting, taking old technical debt and paying it down, which is already really cool to be able to pay down the technical debt. But the week just gone, I was deploying new stuff that had never been deployed before. And I didn't start by doing it on a server. I started by writing the Ansible playbook. And I did my first deploy I debugged my Ansible playbook on the first deploy. And at any stage, if I made a mistake, Ansible would fix it the next pass through because it's declarative. So if I make the file with the wrong permissions, well, the second time I fix my playbook and I run it again, and now it fixes the permissions because reality is now out of sync with what I've asked for.
Yeah.
And then when I was done, because we had to deploy the same agent to our entire estate. Like we had to employ, it was a Windows agent and a Linux agent, but we had to employ an agent universally, which would have been a gigantic chore, right? But I did it once and I wrote it as a playbook from moment one. Step one, use curl to download the file. Okay, great. Is the file been downloaded? Yes. Don't download it again. Step two, run the yum install. Da, 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 step, 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 step. And then when I was done on one server, I just basically went Ansible, Ansible-playbook. I just ran it. And instead of saying minus minus limit to my test host, I left out the limit and just let it run through the inventory. And it just did them all.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, so, you know, what did you do yesterday? I spent 3 days deploying the agent to one server. What did you do today? I spent 5 minutes deploying the agent to 99 servers.
That's interesting because, so you basically, you have a predefined set and it will run it against that. I like that. The way we have to do it with Semantic Ghost is when we're pushing jobs to a bunch of servers at once, we have to select them all. And as you can imagine, that's fraught with peril.
Yes, it is. So at Ansible, you have your inventory as a whole is basically the full set, but your inventory has groups. So you would actually say at the top of a playbook, hosts colon, and then either all or hostname comma hostname or name of a group.
Mm-hmm.
So you, in this case, because I was doing an agent to our entire estate, it was just hosts all, but I could also have host web servers, host database servers, host project one, right? Or
yeah,
just two specific hosts. So if I was doing a set of five that belong to something that obviously have some sort of a logical name, and I'd group them, and then I just say Ansible, whatever, host colon that.
The grouping thing would be perfect, because we have things like each tool, each module, each big semiconductor test module has a handler controller, has a tester controller, it has something called a DPC, which is a data path controller. It's got image processor servers. It's got all these different kinds. And of course, they all have the same base Windows build on them, Windows Server, but then they all have different functions, so they all get different pieces of software that are company is written. And yeah. So you got to be, so one of the things you can do with Ghost is put scripts in there. So we have scripts that at least check to see that the server name matches the type of server that you're pushing software to. Yeah. But that's interesting. I like the idea of grouping and being able to just say, push it to this group. I mean, it can do that in some ways, some limited ways, but not exactly like what you're describing.
The other thing you get for free, because it's YAML based, is you now have infrastructure as code.
Yeah.
And you have it all in a Git repository. So I can roll back our infrastructure. So I can basically, if I decide to add some extra auditing to our, let me say I update the config file for our Microsoft Defender agent, and suddenly it's hammering every CPU. Well, I can just roll it back in Git and just reapply Ansible. And it will reapply it the way it was yesterday, and it'll take back out my silly change, and, you know, sanity will return.
I like that. That's one area we definitely don't use enough of, is version control. Now, the guys who are writing the software for us that we're deploying and working with to steer the direction of and get features implemented, those guys, of course, do use version control. Well, at least they're supposed to. There was one incident where a guy...
I hope so.
Yeah, there was one incident where a guy made a bunch of changes, didn't use version control, and then it broke a lot of things, and it took forever to fix it. It's not the best way to do your programming, but...
No, it's a couple of years ago now I started sysadmining like a programmer. And initially I would just have Git repositories everywhere. So every server would have a little Git repo checked out for the config for Apache or the config for whatever. But now with Ansible, it's one giant big Git repo that holds the Ansible rules. But the effect is the same. And it has gotten us out of hot water on quite a few occasions now. Where I have just been able to go, don't worry, it was fine last week. Yes, I shall make it be like that again.
Roll back time, Bart.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. That'll give me something to go look at. And you have a lot of different things going on the internet. What things do you want to point people to get learn from you and enjoy listening to your voice?
BartB.ie links out to everything is probably the simple easiest. And you can spell that because my surname is just an initial, which is why I got that domain. Because initially I own BartBouchots.ie as well, but that turned out to be quite useless.
I confess, I always... stumble over, is it two S's? Which ones do I double, which ones do I not?
Well, there's two S's together, and then there's one S on the end, and there's only one T, and for reasons I don't know, people love doubling up on that T on the end. Even work, and I've worked there since 2005.
That's like my daughter's school used to get her name wrong every year, but they used to get it wrong in a different way every year, so.
Aw, creativity.
Well, thank you. I know that you're... As we've just been discussing, you are super busy, but you graciously took time to come hang out for a little while, and I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, I had great fun talking to you. I can't believe it's been an hour. That just flew by. You know, it's a holiday weekend. I have a 4-day weekend because Ireland still does the whole Good Friday thing. So this is just such a nice way to take a little bit of fun on a holiday weekend when I'm not stressed. So, yeah, thank you. It was really nice talking to you.